sky. Look, it's a bird.
It's a plane.
It's Superman.
And now, Superman, amazing figure from another world with powers and abilities never before realized by mortal men. Given a chance to make good by Perry White, city editor of the Daily Planet, young Clark Kent, who was really Superman, leaped out a window 20 stories above the ground and vanished in a swirl of fog.
That is a clip from the 1940 radio series, The Adventures of Superman. Superman first appeared in Action Comics in 1938, and since that time, his story has been told and retold on radio, television, and film. He's been animated and special effected almost to death. Now the story of the creators of Superman, Jerry Siegel and Joe Shuster, is the subject of a new book called Superboys, The Amazing Adventures of Jerry Siegel and Joe Shuster, the Creators of Superman. Joining us now to discuss the story of Superman and his creators is author Brad Ricca. He lives in Cleveland and teaches at Case Western Reserve University. Welcome to the show.
Hi, and great to be here.
If anyone has a question or comment for Brad, give us a call, 614-292-8513, or email us at allsides@wosu.org. You teach a class on comic books, right?
Yeah, I mean, it sounds, you know, I mean, it is a dream come true, but yeah, I actually do a college class on comic books.
And Superman, is that a big part of the equation for you?
Yeah, I think it has to be. It's kind of, I look at it, you know, if you're taking a chemistry class, you know, you spend a lot of time on hydrogen, right, on water, you know, the thing that starts everything, that's the basis of everything. So you have to start with Superman. I mean, it's the first superhero, which is, you know, you think of all the superheroes that are kind of flying around on movies and action figures and T-shirts. And so you have to look at the first one to kind of see where it came from and why.
And the first one, in many ways, was an everyman. Of course, those of us who knew that it was Superman could see, you know, the beneath the surface. But to the naked eye, it was just a nerdy guy, awkward and nerdy, and all of these kinds of things. And that, when I read the book and I read about the young Joe and Jerry, I see it there. They wrote about themselves.
Yeah, and that was the really surprising thing for me is, you know, getting into this character and realizing how autobiographical it was. Because that's really the genius of the character. Because if it was just some guy, you know, with his underwear on the outside and the spit curl, yeah, I don't know if it would have lasted for 75 years. But there was that idea that it was also, you know, Clark Kent, who was just this nerdy, meek, mild-mannered guy. And that's what the kids who first bought, you know, Superman identified as. And they said, wait a minute, this isn't some, you know, hero who I could never become. This is, you know, very much like me. So I think that's what did it for people.
You're listening to All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. My guest is Brad Ricca. He's the author of a new book. It's called Superboys, The Amazing Adventures of the Creators of Superman. If you have a question or comment, give us a call, 614-292-8513, or email us at allsides@wosu.org. You can also check out our Facebook page and post your question or comment there. You describe yourself as something of a nerd, and I was wondering how inspired you were by that to do the book, or what brought it about.
Yeah, you know, it's kind of cool to be a nerd now. You know, there's all these shows, there's the Big Bang Theory and all this stuff. But, you know, when I was in junior high, you know, reading comic books, it wasn't really that cool. You know, everybody has kind of the Clark Kent glasses now. I mean, I do. And if I wore these in seventh grade, you know, I probably would have got punched in them and they'd have a big piece of tape on them. Yeah, but I think it's, you know, being a nerd is, there's a real power to it. And that's what inspired me, you know, really about their story. And what really got me about their story is they have this kind of blissful ignorance that you see in a lot of, you know, artists and creators and anyone who's doing something that other people say, you know, you can't do that. You're not trained. You need to go to school for 30 years. And they just didn't care. They just did it anyway. And you see that play out with so many other you know, works of art or even career paths. And I really love that because, you know, I'd never written a biography before, you know, but I figured, well, they, you know, did a comic, so why I can try it too. So I think it's a great story there.
Yeah, the way you write it, and if what you write is accurate, these two are very gifted people. They were passionate about what they did. They stayed up late at night. I mean, the idea that a kid is taking the typewriter all the way down to the basement to write at night when he's just, 12, 13 years old?
Yeah.
That's giftedness.
Yeah, and it's the kind of previous versions of the story all, you know, they're very kind of mythic that, you know, one of them, Jerry, wakes up in the middle of the night and all of a sudden the story's in his head, you know, and really that's not the case. There was all this hard work, you know, they were, you know, extremely gifted writer and an artist, but they worked really hard and just would not take no for an answer.
Immediately, well, in your, you start the story with some tragedy and you start the story with giving me the feeling that they're part of the helpless. They need to be saved.
Yeah, and I think a lot of that's due to, you know, the times they came up with the idea. You know, so it's the Great Depression. It's Cleveland. You know, Cleveland's depressing enough as it is. I mean, put it in the Great Depression, it's even worse. You know, nobody had jobs, and these two kids were in high school. They had no chance of going on to college. They had no money. Joe, the artist, you know, really wanted to go to art school, but his parents told him, you know, we don't have it. You know, you have to find a job doing something else. And, you know, right in the middle of all that, Jerry Siegel's father, who runs his own clothing store, dies. The robbers come into his store and... I don't want to give away kind of what happens because I try to tell it in the book as kind of like the stories they read, you know, these real kind of pulpy adventure stories. And, you know, something happens and his father dies. And, you know, when you're 17 years old and your father dies, but you're also dealing with all these issues of what am I going to do with my life? You know, everyone's telling me I can't be the thing I really want to be, you know, I think it's no coincidence that a year later they start, you know, sending Superman out.
How'd they meet?
There's a couple stories, and it's kind of funny because if you go up to Cleveland and kind of, you know, throw a stone, you know, you might hit three people who, you know, have a Superman story. I think what happened is Jerry was at Glenville High School, and Joe Schuster was at a different high school, and one of their cousins knew the other one and kind of put them together. And it was basically kind of a, you know, hey, my cousin's really into this, you know, nerdy science fiction that you really like. You'd really like him. You should look him up.
Because science fiction was brand new then.
Yeah.
And as we know it today.
Yeah, and that's kind of hard for us to kind of digest. Yeah. I mean, science fiction was so new, and it was so nerdy. You know, like now all these big movies, you know, with the explosions and Star Trek. But back then it was just these magazines that these boys were reading, and it was really looked down upon.
What significance do you place on Superman being created by two Jewish young men during the lead-up to World War II? Anything?
Oh, yeah. I think there's, you know, I mean, the whole country is, you know, feeling this darkness, you know, growing across the ocean, just, you know, knowing that we're going to be a part of it. And I think they had a kind of really focused version of that because both of their parents came from Europe, you know, really fled Europe, just beat it, you know, and Europe is kind of exploding with all this violence. And in many ways, it's just like Krypton, you know, it's exploding and let's just get everybody over to the new planet of America. So that's definitely part of it. And some of the, Jerry wrote about this in his high school newspaper, you know, wrote about how much he hated Hitler, you know, and this is like 1933. But at the same time, you know, they're first generation Jewish Americans. So they're also dealing with the fact that, you know, they're here in America. And at the same time, you know, they're seeing all this American culture, you know, kind of filling up their lives. But at the same time, their parents are very old world. You know, they're both Orthodox. They're speaking this strange language and doing these, you know, strange customs that maybe not all their friends do, too. So they're kind of, you know, wrestling between both sides of their heritage, you know, the kind of old world European Jewish way of life and, you know, all the promise that America had for them.
How did they then come up with this completely, the classic red-blooded American boy off the farm imagery?
Yeah, I mean, that's really the question, right? Because in the beginning, you know, he shows up, the rocket crashes, and he ends up in an orphanage. But it's very much the Midwest. It just shows these fields. And then, you know, a few years later, they alter it even more. So it's, you know, Kansas or someplace in the Midwest. It's really strange because, you know, he immediately, a few issues later, moves to Metropolis. And that's how we identify Superman being in this big gleaming city, you know, kind of fake New York, even better. But he still has those Midwestern roots. And I think a lot of that has to do with the fact that that's where they were living, you know?
I guess. I mean, I think of them as coming from a big city themselves. Cleveland was the third biggest city by population in the country at the time.
Yeah.
And I think of them as coming from an urban area, but they would have been close enough to the fields to know what one looked like.
Yeah, and I just had a conversation with someone about this, the exact same thing. They said, well, no one was really farming in Cleveland, and no one was.
Yeah, it's very industrial.
Yeah, in their first origin, Superman just shows up at an orphanage. And orphanages back then were, you know, really scary places because, you know, that's where you could end up if your parents died or something like that. But then, you know, the comics themselves move him kind of more in the center because it makes him, you know, and everyone has this weird version of what Midwest means, you know. I mean, now, just like you said, you know, Cleveland definitely was a huge urban center. But when that starts to go away, they start looking for a new identity and, oh, we're the Midwest, you know, and we're not nearly as Midwest as Columbus is, you know. So it's this really strange thing. But because Superman's so good and so noble and perfect, there's some kind of, you know, national that it's, you know, well, he must be from Kansas or he must be from somewhere in the Great Plains. Yeah.
My guest is Brad Ricca. He's the author of a new book. It's called Superboys, The Amazing Adventures of the Creators of Superman. If you have a question or comment, want to talk about your favorite Superman episode, whether it's on radio, television, maybe the movies, do you have a favorite? Give us a call, 614-292-8513, or email us at allsides@wosu.org. We'll be right back. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News.
Kids growing up in poverty know that graduating high school and going to college is almost everything.
If you don't have a college degree, you're always living paycheck to paycheck, struggling, and then you always end up doing something you don't want to do.
I'm Kai Risnall, looking forward to graduation day on our series One School, One Year. Next time on Marketplace, it's from APN.
This afternoon at 6 on 89.7 NPR News.
Support comes from the Homeport Noble on Long condominiums, offering homeownership opportunities in the King Lincoln District, featuring green design buildings within walking distance of local stores and restaurants. Details at homeportohio.org/NOBO on Long.
The WOSU Member Card Benefit of the Month for June is the Wexner Center for the Arts. Enjoy 2-for-1 admission to the galleries all month long. Visit WOSU.org.
That is the theme song from the television series Smallville. The show reimagined the adventures of Clark Kent as a high school student in Smallville, Kansas. This hour, we're talking about the creators of Clark Kent, a.k.a. Superman. Those creators were high school students themselves when they met in Cleveland, Ohio. Still with us is Brad Ricca. His new book is called Superboys, The Amazing Adventures of Jerry Siegel and Joe Shuster, the Creators of Superman. And once again, Brad, thanks for joining us. Listeners, if you have a question about Superman, anything you ever wanted to know, Brad's kind of written the book on it, so you can give us a call, 614-292-8513, or email us at allsides@wosu.org. I'll tell you my favorite old-timey Superman episode if you want to share yours, 614-292-8513. The name Superman was first used by the duo for the name of a supervillain bent on world destruction, right? More like a Lex Luthor.
Yeah, yeah, which is really strange because, yeah, you know, they're working out this idea and they, you know, have this great word Superman that's, you know, showing up all over the stuff they're reading. But they make him a villain and he has all these mind powers and he's bald and he looks just like Luthor. And they publish it in this little magazine. They, you know, kind of mimeograph at high school and they think it's going to be this huge hit and it totally bombs. You know, they get like 3 subscribers. So the one really interesting thing about their story is that they're so adaptable that they know, you know, well, it's not going to work as a villain. People don't really want to read about villains. Let's make him a hero.
How else did, well, you know, I was interested to read that Superman came out as we know him just about the same time Mickey Mouse did.
Yeah. Mickey's a little earlier.
Okay.
But you're right. There's that same, they're the two, and they're still the top two. And a lot of people say Mickey Mouse is number one. You know, if you go anywhere in the world, people know who Mickey Mouse is, and Superman's always number two. But I think there was a real part of the reason, you know, that Superman was eventually bought is people were seeing, you know, what Disney was doing with Mickey Mouse. Is he was, you know, a master at immediately, you know, putting him in all these different media. You know, he was in the newspapers as a cartoon, as a comic strip, and then the cartoons, and then just, you know, growing out into this huge conglomerate. And that's what, you know, they thought, well, maybe Superman, I mean, this is just a thought, could do that.
And at one point, didn't Mickey Mouse play Superman?
Yeah. Oh, yeah. They all do. At one point, Donald Duck does, Bugs Bunny does in a really famous kind of propaganda World War II cartoon. It's really strange. Everyone wants to put on the tights and cape.
Bruce in Sunbury, you're on the air. Welcome, Bruce.
Hi. It's never been clear to me how quickly the powerfulness of Superman evolved. It's my understanding the first comic book, yeah, he was able to leap tall buildings, but he couldn't actually fly, as I understand it. Can you give me a clearer idea of how long it took for him to become a demigod, almost?
Yeah, that's a great question, Bruce. And you're right, in the beginning, he can just leap tall buildings. That's what I mean. Is that was more than enough. Is you see this vision of this guy kind of leaping stuff, and he was very much a track and field star. I mean, I have all these, you know, pictures in the book how they literally traced out pictures of, you know, as Columbus knows, the great Jesse Owens. You know, they wanted someone who could, you know, run and jump, and they just took photos of him and, you know, kind of put a cape on him. So yeah, it takes a while. It starts with the cartoon a little bit in the 40s. He starts, you know, jumping even more and it starts looking like flying. And then in the radio show, you know, where they really put that sound effect on, really makes it happen. But it's kind of, you know, in the beginning, it was so strange that even just, you know, jumping was more than enough for the audience. And as time kind of went on, they and other superheroes showed up and some of them could fly, it seemed like they, you know, made Superman just more and more powerful.
Bruce?
They kind of overdid that. It got to the point where he had no viable enemies except for kryptonite and people from other planets. And so it got to be almost silly. It was so predictable as to what would happen in each episode.
Yeah, and that's one of the real kind of still, you know, contemporary knocks on the character, that it's too powerful. And one thing I go into in the book is how kryptonite came to be. There was a big event at the 1940 World's Fair in New York, which was the first time somebody ever put on a Superman costume, and they trotted him out and said, "This is Superman," and the kids went nuts. But, you know, the day after that, there was a terrorist bombing at the fair, and kind of, you know, war is right around the corner. And it made kind of the creators and the publisher kind of rethink, you know, is this really a character that can exist in the real world, you know, with all this madness going on? And, you know, eventually Kryptonite develops out of that.
Thanks a lot, Bruce, for your call. We appreciate
it. Thank you.
Take care.
Yeah.
What inspired the visual look of both Clark Kent? I guess I get the nerdy thing, but all things being equal, he was also nice looking, and Superman. So they didn't make him. They made him an attractive Clark Kent, but where'd they come up with the spit curl and the? You said the Jesse Owens physique, but Superman in an event really didn't have a Jesse Owens physique.
No, he had the kind of the Jesse Owens moves.
Yeah.
I think the spit curl, and I have a lot of pictures of this in the book, the spit curl in the face, I think, were Johnny Weissmuller. They both really liked Tarzan, and they went and saw him. You know, he would do these shows, these swimming shows, and they were up in Cleveland for a summer, you know, and he really has, there's one picture with him with the curl, and it's Superman. And there's a lot of there were strong men, you know, the costume came kind of from there. There was a lot of cartoonists they really liked. Joe the artist really liked Terry and the Pirates, which, you know, if you go to OSU Zone, you know, the new building's going to be open in November, and the comics world can't wait. You know, the Billy Ireland cartoon library, they have all those all that art, and Joe really liked that stuff. And if you look at it, it's very similar to those early Superman.
You're listening to All Sides with Dan Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. My guest is Brad Ricca. He's the author of a new book about where Superman came from. It's called Super Boys, The Amazing Adventures of Jerry Siegel and Joe Shuster, the creators of Superman. If you have a question or comment, want to share your favorite old Superman episode, whether it's from the film, the television, radio, or maybe the comic books, give us a call, 614-292-8513, or email us at allsides@wosu.org. You can also check out our Facebook page and post your question or comment there. So you said they're very adaptable, and again, that was part of a little bit of part of their giftedness, too, as they were able to adapt. They did have trouble getting Superman into print, though, as a character. Tell us about that.
Yeah, and there's all these great stories of, you know, people who would go on to become really famous comics creators and publishers who would say, yeah, I remember, they sent it to me, and I said no, and every day I hit myself. They spent several years trying to get it published, and what it really came down to, it was just too crazy. You know, they would get all these rejection letters saying, no one will ever believe this. It's so different. And, you know, they never let it, bring him down. They kept, you know, they would alter things. They would change things. But the core of the character was the same, and because they really believed that it would be a success, because this is what they wanted to see. And eventually somebody took a chance and, you know, then it hit big.
So it hit big, and then they gave it away.
Yeah, I mean, and that's one of, you know, I think there's like any story, you know, there's a lot of tragedy in this book. There's certainly lots of high points, but lots of tragedy. And, you know, one that, you know, a lot of people seize on is that they make this great character, you know, spend years trying to sell it. And when they sell it, you know, it's for 10 bucks a page, 130 bucks. But, you know, you sign the check, and on the back, it's, you know, you relinquish all rights of the character in perpetuity. So, you know, everything that comes after, you know, for 75 years, movies, cartoons, film, everything, you know, they don't take a part of it.
Did they not understand, or did they just not think it would ever get that big?
I think both sides, you know. I think on one hand, it was their, you know, dream to be published. I mean, they really want it. And I go into, there's no really way of knowing for sure, because back then, it's the 30s, you know, the publishing industry certainly was extremely corrupt. Very little was on paper. So it's hard to say if one side took advantage of the other. I think that, you know, over time, you can certainly say that. But I don't think they really knew how big it would be. But I know that Jerry and Joe really wanted it to be in the newspapers. And I think they saw this as a way of getting in the newspapers. And as I argue in the book, I think that the publishers, the argument's always been, well, they didn't know this was a standard contract. But I think they did know. I think they had an idea that this could be a big licensing opportunity, because you see Superman starting to go into other kinds of media almost immediately. And that didn't happen with other things. So I think they did know right away and were, kind of happy that they got it for so little.
The stories originally took place in Cleveland. What are the vestiges of Cleveland in the stories? Are there any? And why the move to Metropolis? I mean, we talked a little bit about where it was and that that's where they grew up. But was that something from the publishers, or was that Jerry and Joe?
Yeah, that's a great kind of unanswered question. In the first few issues, it's very street level crime. He's beating up gangsters, men who are abusing their wives and things like that. He does go down to what seems the state capitol to stop an execution, though it doesn't say where that is. But then at one point, Clark is telegraphing a story back to the paper and he says, send it to Cleveland, Ohio. And it's this moment, wow, this is taking place in Cleveland. But, two issues later, they're in Metropolis. So it seems like, and they were in Cleveland in the beginning, but the publisher was in New York and they said, we want you in New York so we can keep an eye on you so you can hit your deadlines. Mm-hmm. So they eventually moved to New York pretty quickly. They would move back, but they went out there. And so I think they wanted to make Metropolis as more kind of an every city. And the idea that, everybody wants to go to, everything happens in New York anyway. So let's make it bigger like that.
So they sold the rights to the cartoon or the comic strip or the Superman for $130, but they kept working on Superman comics.
Yeah. And that's another part of the myth that people
kind of
think.
A weird foster child sort of experience.
Yeah. And that is almost the perfect analogy, because they did work on Superman for 10 years and made very good money doing it. They never owned the character, but they made very good money. They still, every time they wanted to raise, there's like 10 letters going back and forth arguing over like a dollar, increase in page rate. So they very much were told who was in charge, and they were threatened a lot. If you don't toe the line, there's the door. Anybody can write and draw Superman. But they did work on the character for 10 years until they, eventually decided to bring a lawsuit, and then they were, let go.
A crucial part of the Superman story was his sometimes complicated relationship with Lois Lane. And as someone who grew up wanting to be a reporter, I didn't like Lois Lane. I thought she gave reporters a bad name. But let's hear a clip from an interaction depicted in Superman, the animated series, which aired from 1996 to 2000.
See, I've lived in Metropolis most of my life, and I can't figure out how some yokel from Smallville is suddenly getting every hot story in town.
Well, Lois, the truth is, I'm actually Superman in disguise, and I only pretend to be a journalist in order to hear about disasters as they happen and then squeeze you out of the byline.
You're a sick man, Kent.
That's kind of rare when he does that, but in your book, you write about the real woman who inspired the character of Lois Lane. Who was she?
Yeah, I mean, this was, I think it's still my favorite part. So she was just this teenager growing up in Cleveland. Kind of a bad home situation, and she wanted out. And like so many of her generation, she wanted to be a Hollywood star. And she didn't know how to do it. So she thought, maybe I could be a model first. So, again, this kind of blissful ignorance, she took out an ad in the Cleveland Plain Dealer that says, model, no experience, leave your, here's the P.O. box number. And it ran for one day. At the same time, the guys are over on the other side of town and they're thinking, well, we really need a kind of, a love interest, whatever. And they start this idea of Lois Lane. But, it's kind of hard to figure out, which part of it is, Joe says, I don't really know how to draw women. We need a model. Or that they're, 16-year-old boys thinking, oh, we can get a model in the house, And so they call, they get in touch with her and she shows up. And there's, you know, it's this great story. She shows up. Joe's mom is present for the entire session, you know, so nothing untoward happens. But it's this really sweet moment. You know, she shows up and she's wearing this, like, you know, 1930s bathing suit, and she's really self-conscious. And Joe just tells her, you know, don't worry, I'll make you look $1 million, you know, and he does. And she just, you know, they become friends for life. And she moves kind of in and out of their lives, and she becomes really the inspiration for not only the character, I mean, not the journalism stuff, but the love triangle. I mean, and that's really, you know, another reason why Superman works. I mean, this idea that, oh, I really like this girl, but she likes somebody else. So wait, that person's me. It's not really me. It's really complicated. But then she comes back into their lives, and she has a huge role in just their entire lives.
There is a love triangle between the three of them.
Yeah, and that had never been out there before. You know, she eventually marries Jerry Siegel years and years later, but for a long time, there's a love triangle between the three of them. You know, and I don't think it's any coincidence that this happens, and then Superman comes out, you know, 3 years later.
You said that Jerry and Joe made a lot of money, but were they ever wealthy people? And I wanted to ask you, too, when they were laid off, when they got rid of them, to go back to the idea of the fact that they were gifted people, gifted children at least, but they never were able to repeat the success they had with Superman. They couldn't come up with someone different.
Yeah. And that's, I think, it wasn't for lack of trying. And one thing I, you know, what really surprised me in this book is how much they did try. All this stuff that's been unpublished, unseen, that they did do, you know, cartoons, movie scripts, comics, always comics. And some of this stuff is really great, but it just never took off, right? So they never stopped trying, which, you know, really impresses me. But you're right, you know, that they couldn't, you know, lightning didn't strike twice for them. And I think that's part of one of the things, you know, kind of the overall book is about is, you know, this book is, you know, Superman is this tremendous fantasy, right? But it's one of those strange characters that's really close to reality. You know, we all refer to him by his, you know, his first name. People see Superman, they'll ask for his autograph, you know, somebody dressed up as him. We know it's completely fake, but we sort of want to believe in it, you know, like somebody else who dresses in red and, you know, flies around. But I don't want to, you know, I don't want to give spoilers for our younger listeners, but it's really strange. And I think it's part of that imagination's great. And I think we need that, especially in times, you know, where the real world can let us down a lot. But there's a real danger in being lost in that imagination. I think the book's a little bit about that, too, is you know, they created this great character, but in some ways they could never let it go.
How many great characters how many cartoonists like them were able to create more than one great character?
Yeah, very, very few. And I think this is the great one. You know, I mean, in their times there was Popeye, but, you know, that was it. There was Lil Abner,
the creator of Lil Abner never created anything else.
No. Yeah.
Right.
That's what I mean. I mean, you know, some of those stories were a little different. They had got to hold on to their characters a little more. But, you know, as far as characters that we know right now in 2013, I mean, it's Superman.
My guest is Brad Ricca. He's author of Superboys, The Amazing Adventures of Jerry Siegel and Joe Shuster, the creators of Superman. You have a favorite cut or a favorite story about Superman you want to share with us? If you have a question or comment, now's the time. 614-292-8513 or email us at allsides@wosu.org. And you also can check out our Facebook page. We'll be right back. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News.
Do you know what you did yesterday?
No, I don't.
How about this morning?
I don't even remember that. Henry Mollison's amnesia, caused by experimental brain surgery for epilepsy in 1953, helped neuroscientists understand how memory works. On the next Fresh Air, we meet Suzanne Corkin, who studied him for decades. Join us.
Today at noon on 89.7 NPR News.
Support for WOSU comes from Edible Columbus, a magazine devoted to culinary traditions, seasonal cooking, and the local food movement in our community. More information on the summer edition coming June 27th can be found at ediblecolumbus.com.
You can discover more about WOSU Public Media by signing up for our WOSU FYIE newsletter. Just visit wosu.org/email to sign up and receive a biweekly arts and culture e-newsletter featuring program highlights from radio and television, special event information, ticket offers, news about WOSU partners, and much more. Visit wosu.org/email right now and sign up for the WOSU FYIE newsletter. 89.7 NPR News is your all-day NPR news station, bringing you news and information 7 days a week and always streaming at WOSU.org.
Welcome back to All Sides with Ann Fisher. This hour, we've been discussing the lives of the creators of Superman. Still with us is Brad Ricca. His new book is Superboys, The Amazing Adventures of Jerry Siegel and Joe Shuster, the creators of Superman. The story of Superman has been told and retold in comic books, radio serials, several television shows, and, of course, movies. Most famous is perhaps the 1978 film starring Christopher Reeves. But a new film is out soon that will once again tell the story of how Kal-El became Clark Kent and how Clark Kent became Superman. Let's hear a clip from Man of Steel.
You will give the people of Earth an ideal to strive towards. They will race behind you. They will stumble. They will fall. But in time, they will join you in the sun. In time, you will help them accomplish wonders.
Jeez. There's a lot of pressure on the kid.
And I think there's a lot of pressure on the character, quite honestly. You know, for the last 10 years, the only superhero, you know, from that side of things, DC Comics, that people have been talking about is Batman. So there's a, they've got this character, but they haven't been able to get a blockbuster movie out of him since the 70s. So I think there is a lot of pressure in more ways than one.
An email from Courtney. As a comic fan and Ohio native, I am loving this show. I was wondering if your guest has any opinion about the animosity between Superman and another comic book idol, Batman. Is it indicative of changing tastes in comics, good fodder for a storyline, or something else?
Yeah, that's a great question, Courtney.
First, tell us about this animosity.
Yeah, I mean, there is an animosity, and I think there's that's part of what makes it such a great relationship in the fiction, is that, you know, Superman's an alien, he has all these powers, he's, you know, intrinsically good. And Batman, the fantasy is very different. I mean, for Batman, it's, you know, if I was rich, if I had, you know, 10 years to go trekking around Nepal, you know, I could be Batman, you know, learn all this karate and I'd be Batman. So there's and he's much darker, you know, both origin stories, their parents die, but Batman's are gunned down before his eyes. And he's very much a street level superhero. So there's this kind of animosity, I think, that started, you know, in the beginning between fans, you know, who do you like better? And they kind of picked up on that in the stories. And there's been, you know, throughout comics, these really great stories between the two where, you know, they're best friends, kind of, but they're always a little bit at arm's length, you know, competitive, making fun of each other. And when they do the relationship like that, you know, in a very kind of human way, it makes for some really great storytelling.
Once again, if you have a question or comment, 614-292-8513 or email us at allsides@wosu.org. You can tweet us at @WOSUAllSides if you'd like, or check out our Facebook page. What the truth, justice, and the American way, Superman was very patriotic in his way, the colors, everything. So truth, justice, and the American way. Where'd that come from?
Yeah, they seem to think that the radio show started that. You know, once the war happens, all the covers of Superman comics become immediately patriotic. He's arm in arm with GIs, and there's tanks behind him. It's interesting that in the comics themselves, he never, you know, goes up against the Nazis or that kind of thing. There's one very kind of strange, you know, just two-page comic where he rounds up all the Axis and, you know, drops them off at The Hague. It's really weird, but they realize that, you know, they have to keep the world separate, that Superman is so strange that they can't have him gallivating around, you know, Europe fighting the Nazis because he would win. You know, they do it with Captain America because, you know, he doesn't have the same power level. But he is patriotic, and it's interesting, you know, because the last movie, they dropped the American way from the phrase. And also in the comics, I think about two years ago, he himself said, you know, I'm no longer for the American way. I'm for the people of Earth. So it'll be interesting to see what the new movie does with that.
What out there, what iteration of Superman do you think identifies most closely with the ideal that they set out with when they finally hit upon it?
That's a great question. I think, you know, the version now is in some ways really different from the one they started with. I mean, the what's fascinating is the core things are the same. You know, Clark, Lois, the cape, the hair, the underwear, that's all the same, more or less. But those early comics are really, really different, and they're really special. And I think what really realized them was the first cartoon series, which came out in the 40s. They were actually, you know, short films, and they took, you know, forever to produce. They were produced by the Fleischer brothers, who were famous. They did Betty Boop and Popeye. And if you watch these today, and they're, you know, they're in the public domain, you can see them on YouTube or buy, you know, better versions. They're really phenomenal. They're just, you know, really motion picture versions of that early Superman. And I think they saw that and just, you know, were blown out of their seats by it.
What about the television show?
Yeah, the television, it's
the original, the first television show.
Yeah, I mean, the thing about Superman is they don't really reinvent the character that much, but every kind of generation or so has their own version of the character, and that depends on what media they're in. So some people grew up with the comics, and a huge portion of people grew up with The Adventures of Superman, that TV show, you know, whether when it ran the first time or when it came back on, you know, Nick at Night or whatever it was on, and people just loved that version, you know. And then after that, I mean, if you ask any you know, kid now, their version of Superman for the last 10 years has been Smallville. Mm-hmm. There was like a little survey, you know, where they asked kids, you know, what does Superman wear? And they all said red T-shirt and jeans. And they were like, no, he has a... But then they realized they're talking about Smallville. So it's really, and I think that's what they're trying, you know, hopefully to do with the new movie is, you know, to give it a version for the next 10 years.
Did the creators live to see the death of Superman in DC Comics?
Almost. I'm trying to think. One of them did, one of them didn't. And that was really the, because one of them was consulted, and it was one of those things that the death of Superman was really the thing that brought it back into popular culture. I mean, I remember I was into comics, but, you know, I was too cool for Superman. I was reading, like, X-Men and stuff like that. But I remember the, you know, it was literally the front page of the paper said Superman to die. and with this picture of the shield, you know, dripping in blood. And this is the front page of the newspaper. And what it did, it, you know, it made me
and
angry.
And it wasn't Metropolis.
No. And it made so many people just this visceral sense of anger. And of course, what did they do with their anger? They went out and bought, you know, a ton of copies of this comic, which, you know, came, you know, in a black plastic cover, and it came with a black armband.
What year was that?
19, I should know that. I think 1992 or okay. 1991. Yeah. And it was, you know, it came with the armband, and it was almost real. You know, people were in mourning over this. And it turned out to be this just tremendous marketing move, right? But it made us seem that, you know, realize that we really like this character, you know, even though we're not spending money on him, you know, we really like him. We don't want him to go away.
And so he hasn't, what are you hoping for out of the new film?
Yeah, I mean, it's, you know, it's kind of tricky because you look at it from a few different perspectives. I'm actually really optimistic about it now because what I've, you know, kind of realized after, you know, writing this book and thinking about all this stuff, what the story's about. And I think, it's not, you know, just about Superman or the creators. It's about kind of, you know, what you do with the imagination. And it's also really about fathers and sons. You know, in many ways, the story of the creators, the story of Superman is kind of Hamlet. And, you know, Hamlet is Hamlet because it's the story of many people in real life. So I think when I saw, you know, that, and we heard that clip in one of the previews, you know, begins with, you know, Jor-El and the planets exploding around him, and he's sending his son off, you know, into space to save him. That means to me that they're getting it right, that they realize that, you know, it isn't really about just, you know, punching the bad guy into, you know, orbit, you know, around some other planet. It's really, you know, this kind of father-son story behind all that.
And a lot of moralizing, too.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, we heard in the clip, you know, yeah. I will send you to be the, I mean, this is, it sounds a lot like, It's religious religious rhetoric, religious dialogue. But so Superman's like the American secular figure that we, you know, look at to kind of save us. But to save us, he becomes one of us. And I think this, you know, when they said, well, we finally got the idea, the great idea for the next Superman movie, you know, it seems to be that there'll be some sort of, you know, self-sacrifice in this one on his part, which, you know, plays into a lot of other, you know, a lot of other things we know about.
We just have a few more minutes left with Brad Ricca. We're talking about Superboys, the amazing adventures of the creators of Superman, although that's an abbreviated version. It's Superboys, the amazing adventures of Jerry Siegel and Joe Shuster, the creators of Superman. If you have a question or comment for Brad, give us a call, 614-292-8513. You can email us at allsides@wosu.org. Superman Radio played a role in the defeat of the KKK?
I think there's a lot of people that claim that.
How did that happen?
I think it's a little bit of a stretch that it did. They did have a series of episodes that involved the KKK.
On the radio?
On the radio.
Which is kind of risky at the time,
wasn't it? Was
it?
Risky. What I found, I think, that was... what really shocked me in the book is that Jerry wrote and Joe illustrated a comic. They did a bunch of comics before Superman, and one of them was called, they had Federal Men, Radio Squad, you know, these real 30-sounding titles. And they had one with where they literally go up against the KKK. So it wasn't kind of thinly disguised, but even more so, they named where it was, and it was Meadville, Pennsylvania, which is, you know, right over the border, and Meadville, Pennsylvania was a bastion of the KKK. So it struck me as really gutsy that this kid who's signing his name on these comics is writing a story about two undercover federal agents going into the KKK. They're called like the White Cloaks or something. And the first picture is them all, you know, assembled around a tree dressed in the costumes. And this seemed me, you know, something an 18-year-old is doing is just, you know, and naming where they're from really gutsy.
Well, I mean, it goes back. They're Jews in the United States, and they're part of the, you know, they're the KKK is anti-Semitic by that time.
Yeah.
And it seems like they weren't afraid of putting themselves out there, which it takes a lot of courage to do what they did.
Yeah. And everyone says, oh, they were nerds. They couldn't talk. I think they found courage in, you know, this sounds like a cliche, and they're right. They had no fear in their writing, literally. I mean, they would write to, you know, girls they liked in school. You know, they would put them as characters in their comics and have them, you know, pursued by vampires, and they would save them. You know, I mean, that's really, really gutsy. But it's great, right? I mean, that's how you do it.
So how did they end up as adults? They not so well, necessarily.
Yeah, I have a lot of, you know, kind of strange stories in the book because, you know, we tend to think that, you know, once they lose Superman, they just stop existing. They do a lot of, you know, really interesting and bizarre things. I have the last script of Jerry Siegel, and Joe at one point joins a mystical cult. But the good news is at the end, they're happy. They eventually, you know, get recognized. They get a pension and a settlement. And, you know, there's a lawsuit, you know, afterwards. It's sort of still going on a little bit. But they end up, the best part of the story is that they end up literally living around the block from each other, which is how it began. You know, they grew up literally down the street from each other, best friends. And in, you know, their twilight years, they're living in Los Angeles just around the block. They see each other, go to lunch, are great friends, and really are enjoying their life. And that really, you know, was nice to find out.
Harlan in Columbus, you're on the air. Welcome, Harlan.
Yeah, one of the things I find interesting about Superman and the creation of him was that he was the ultimate immigrant experience, and that I wonder if you think that he fell off in popularity in the 90s in particular, and maybe even extending in today because of a reaction to the immigration question.
He's an outsider. He's an alien.
Right, as opposed to Batman, who's a good American.
Thank you, Harlan.
Yeah, that's a great question because I think it was, that's a great question because I think it, you know, early on people could easily see through, you know, see past the metaphor that it was an immigrant experience, you know, which kind of everyone knew. But now, yeah, that's a much different experience. And I don't, you know, I think in some ways Superman can still speak to it a little bit because he's always the outsider, always the alien. He doesn't necessarily have to be a European immigrant, right? He can just be the outsider. But it is different. And I wonder, I'm sort of agreeing with you a little bit. I wonder if that didn't, you know, affect his popularity a little bit.
Thanks, Harlan.
And he isn't, you know, he's from another planet. He is the ultimate alien and can be kind of iconic for people throughout the world who want to come to America.
Yeah, I mean, he's a real I think you're absolutely right. He's not only the icon for, you know, oh, he got here, let's see what he can do, but for, you know, I want to come here and do well. That's a very good point.
Certainly don't want to encourage that. Thanks, Harlan, for your call. We appreciate it. You're looking forward to the movie?
Yeah, I am. I am.
Do you think it's going to be like part of a trilogy, or do we already know that?
I think they're really hoping for it, but I'm like, you know, one of the few people in the universe who really liked the last one.
With Christopher Reeves?
No, the one they did in 2007,
right.
Which
that's
everybody
right.
forgets,
yep.
You know, because nobody went to go see it. But I liked it. Yeah, I think they're going to, you know, you can always kind of tell if they sell a lot of the stuff in Target that it'll probably be a built-in blockbuster. So I think we can expect 3 movies, which will be good.
Okay. Well, Brad Ricca, thanks so much for joining us today to talk about it.
Thank you. My pleasure.
Brad Ricca, author of Super Boys, The Amazing Adventures of Jerry Siegel and Joe Shuster, the creators of Superman, just came out. Thanks for listening. And this is listener supported, WOSU 89.7 and WOSU HD1 Columbus, and streaming on the web at WOSU.org. 89.7 NPR News, your all-day NPR news station, a service of WOSU Public Media.